Let us commence our service this morning by singing hymn number 205. Praise, O praise our God and King. Hymns of adoration sing, for his mercies still endure, ever faithful, ever sure. Hymn 205. Very pleased to welcome Ed and Sister Wynne's Coverley. So before the exhortation, we're going to sing hymn 175. Hymn 175. Thou hidden love of God, whose height, whose depth unfathomed, no man knows. I see from far thy beauteous light, inly I sigh for thy repose. My heart is pained, nor can it be at rest till it find rest in thee. Hymn 175. So I'm very pleased now to invite Brother Ed Coverley to prepare us in mind before we come to partake of the emblems.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. This Luke chapter 16 falls in the middle of several different parables about various different things. And this particular chapter I've always had a little bit of difficulty understanding, and I don't think I'm necessarily the only one. That story of the rich man and Lazarus is one that's been used quite extensively in the past by people who'd like to prove that there is a hell, a sort of a physical hell. People who perhaps don't understand that the story is a parable, it's a symbol, a picture, rather than being a literal story. And that's something that we ought to remember with most of these parables, is that they're stories, they're an illustration rather than necessarily a physical event that's happened. The one in this chapter, though, that really confused me, and probably sometimes still does, is that one right at the start of the chapter, the parable, as it's titled in my Bible, of the shrewd manager. And the reason for that is that with most of Jesus' parables, I suppose without trying to be irreverent, they're sort of like a pantomime, in the sense that you can clearly see the different roles. You can see the people that are doing good and the people that are doing bad, and you can also see a fairly clear moral from the story. But in this parable of the shrewd manager, we find a man who appears to be acting dishonestly being commended for what he's done. And then we read a moral that at first glance seems quite confusing, because we've just seen a man who hasn't been necessarily trustworthy in dealing with the things that have been entrusted to him. And the moral of the story seems to be about being trustworthy with things. It's slightly difficult, I think, to reconcile these two items. So we'll have a look at the parable and try and do that by way of exhortation this morning. In verse 1 of Luke chapter 16, we read that Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions." And this would seem to link with many of Jesus' other parables. We have a rich man who goes away for a time, and he entrusts his estate, he entrusts his possessions to, in this case, an individual. In other parables, we read of three servants perhaps being entrusted with the possessions of the master. And the manager is accused, seemingly by other people, of wasting these possessions, or perhaps we could use the term talents. And at this stage, he's not accused of being dishonest. He's not accused of being unjust. The accusation is wastage. It's of not working hard enough for his master to put the things that have been entrusted to him to work. And this accusation is the same one that was levelled at the servant in the parable of the talents in Luke chapter 19. Luke 19, reading from verse 20. "Another servant came and said, 'Sir, here is your talent. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you're a hard man. You take out what you put in and reap what you did not sow.' And his master replies, 'I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. Why didn't you put my money on deposit so that when I came back, I could have collected it with interest?'" So the standards that are set in both of these parables by the master or the rich person are high standards, but not necessarily unattainable standards, particularly in that second parable, the parable of the talents, because the other two servants who'd been entrusted with more talents were able to put them to work to gain more talents for their master and to please him. In this parable of the unjust steward, the parable of the shrewd manager, there seem to be some outstanding debts as well that the steward may have been responsible for. Another example, perhaps, of him not being diligent enough in his work. So the master seems to examine his accounts, and in the same way as in the parable of the talents, he calls the steward, the manager, to him in order to account for what he's done. And he tries to find out why he hasn't done more with the things that he's been entrusted with. He says in verse 2, "What is this I hear about you? Give me an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer." And just a note here that the rich man doesn't say that the manager will no longer have a job, just that his position of trust, his position as a manager, will end. And perhaps the rich man feels some pity for the manager. And it seems to be the case that the manager is being sacked, but if that is the case, then it seems that he's being given one last chance to redeem himself in the sight of the rich man whose possessions he's been looking after. And the manager now is distraught. He says to himself, "What shall I do now? My master's taken away my job, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg." He sees this as an end of a way to make a living. And we get a real insight into the manager's personality, and perhaps our first big clue that we're not supposed to follow the example of this steward or manager. Because the human aspects we see in this statement, "I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg," are ones that we see in ourselves sometimes, aren't they? Our inherent laziness and our inherent pride. "I'm not strong enough and I'm ashamed." Matthew's account of the parable of the talents includes the line, "You wicked lazy servant." He doesn't just call the servant wicked, he calls him lazy as well. And we know that we're also encouraged not to be proud. We know that in the Proverbs it tells us it comes before destruction and before a fall. So, the manager decides to take it upon himself to do things which can ensure his continued survival. He's made the assumption that he's going to be unemployed. "When I lose my job here," is the words he uses. He says, "I know what I'll do so that when I do lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So again, it appears that this manager hasn't made many friends in his dealings. Maybe perhaps due to his scheming and lazy ways. But he expects now to be able to buy favours from those who are indebted to his master. Perhaps when I've used the word friends to try and buy friends, it's not a very good use of the word there, but there we are. Anyway, he calls in his master's debtors. And we read, "What do you owe my master?" And the first one says 800 gallons of oil. And he's told to sit down and make the bill 400. And the second has 1,000 bushels of wheat. And he's told to take it and make it 800. Now, these were very significant amounts of oil and wheat. I understand that to make 800 gallons of olive oil in a growing season, you'd need around 150 olive trees. And to make 1,000 bushels of wheat, you'd need to have roughly 100 acres of land to be able to produce that amount of wheat. And that sounds to me, even these days, with very large farms in this country, that's a huge amount to owe. And also, not only would the people have to pay these debts back, but also out of the land that they had, they would have had to make their own living. So actually what the manager is doing here is taking the role of one of these sort of finance management companies that sometimes we see advertised on the television, who offer to consolidate all your existing debts into one low monthly payment and do that sort of thing. Because the first thing that these companies do, from what I understand, is to speak to the creditors and say to the creditors, "Well, look, you might have a struggle getting all of this money back from this particular customer. So if we can get some of the debt written back, then at least you'll get some of your money returned." So to use a modern phrase, then, everyone here suddenly becomes a winner. The master is able to recover debts that he might not otherwise have been able to recover. The debtors were now in a position where, perhaps with a lower and more manageable payment, they would be able to repay some of the things that they owed. And the steward was now, again, to think in a modern sense, owed a few favours by the people whose debts he'd forgiven. And it seems, perhaps, that in maybe a human twist to the story from the point of view of the master, that by acting very cunningly, perhaps we could say, the manager may have got his job back. Verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager because he'd acted so shrewdly. And this is another example, perhaps, of human nature that makes us realise that perhaps we are not going to be characters in this parable. They might not be as recognisable as in other parables. The manager is rewarded, essentially, for cheating. It's something that perhaps we see more and more in this life, that the people who seem to cut corners and do things improperly seem to be the ones who are sometimes very successful. It's the modern policy, and I have to confess that I've been known to use it at work once or twice, which I should be ashamed. It's the modern policy of it being better to seek forgiveness than to ask permission, perhaps. But then Jesus says something that does appear to be strange when he's describing the parable. He says, "The people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light." And at first glance, that would appear to tell us that Jesus is promoting shrewdness among the people of the light, among us, suggesting that we emulate the people of this world. But the dictionary tells us that being shrewd means disposed to artful and cunning practices and tricky. Surely Jesus is not encouraging us to be tricky. So I think then that this parable is much more of a cautionary tale than perhaps some of Jesus' other parables, and perhaps that appears at first glance. Let's imagine and rewrite this parable slightly, so that rather than having an unjust and a dishonest and a shrewd steward of the world, the steward was somebody else. So the rich man entrusts his affairs to this just steward, this honest manager. On his return, he finds that the talents that he's entrusted to the manager have accumulated and have grown. Unfortunately, as is the case in business, this has resulted in large amounts of debt due to the master, as there are more and more tenants of the land as the wealth accumulates. So what does the steward do? Should he take the initiative, as did the shrewd steward? And let's not forget that in this parable, as in the last, the debtors are unable to pay off the things that they owe. No, the manager instead speaks to the master, and he asks the master to write off the balance owed by each debtor, because these debtors are his friends, not for his own personal gain. And so, rather than the debts partially being written off due to the shrewdness of the manager, the debts are completely written off because of the love and the friendship of the manager. And we can imagine who that steward might be. So we're encouraged to emulate not the steward in the parable, but by inference, the steward who's not in the parable, the just steward, the honest manager. Firstly, we put our talents to work so that we can give a good account of ourselves when our master returns. Jesus goes on to point out, as we said earlier in verse 10 of this chapter, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? So if we wish to live with Jesus as kings and as priests, administering a kingdom, we need to show that now we can handle that responsibility in our lives. At work, at school, in our dealings with the things that go on in our lives, whether they be when we're going to the shops or anything else that we might be doing that requires a level of trust, we have to demonstrate that trust. In our spiritual lives, also, we are trusted, we are responsible for aiding each other on our journey towards the kingdom. And then the second part of the example to follow is that in dealing with each other and in dealing with those people around us, we do it not in shrewdness, not by being tricky to attain personal gain and personal gain in this life, but in love and in order to attain treasure in heaven. And this brings us on to another slightly strange comment that Jesus seems to make. That at first glance, again, seems at odds with the rest of his teaching. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself. This is verse 9, sorry. Use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it's gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. That seems to be telling us that we should use the money that we have to buy the friendship of others, perhaps with lavish and expensive gifts. I'm sure I'd welcome it if anyone wanted to do that for me, but I don't think that would be necessarily appropriate. It's not telling us that we should use our money to buy friendship. It's offering those things which God has given us, whether that be our time or our skills or perhaps our money, to help those around us, again, through love. But unlike the just manager who we've imagined, we can't write off any of the debt that we or the others owe to God due to our sin. This can only be done through God's mercy. And if we need to understand how much mercy God has already shown to us, we only have to think about talents and about how God has already given us an investment to work with, because we know that God put enough trust in us, saw enough in us, that he was prepared to invest the life of his Son in us. That's the amount of responsibility we have, brothers and sisters. God saw that we could work for him. God saw that we could be responsible enough. He was confident that we could work hard towards places in his kingdom, and so confident that he was willing to give up the life of his own Son on the cross so that we could be his children and brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ. And that we see illustrated in another of Jesus' parables in Luke chapter 20. There's no need to turn to it because you know it well. The rich landowner rents his vineyard out to some tenants, and they don't seem to be a very nice bunch of people, do they? Because when it was harvest time, when they were called to give up their debts, he sent servants to them, but they beat the servants and sent them away empty-handed. And eventually the wealthy landowner, the owner of the vineyard, says, "What shall I do? I'll send my son, whom I love, and perhaps they will respect him." But the tenants discussed it amongst themselves and decided to kill the son. And they killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. And we know that that son was our master, our elder brother Jesus, the stone that the builders rejected, the stone that would become the capstone. We know that when it comes to our reckoning, when it comes to the time when we need to give an account to directly to our master, that we will be judged justly. But we have to hope, and we have confidence in that hope by what God has already done for us, that, to use another colloquialism, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. With Jesus making intercession for us, we have a great hope that our debt, our sins, will be written off. And so, as we remember Jesus now, we recognise in him both an example for us, a fantastic example of the things that we should do, the work that we should do with what God has given us. But also, it's a reminder that God has already seen in each of us something that was worth, and it sounds incredible to say it, doesn't it? Something that was worth giving up his only son for, so that we could all be Jesus' brothers and sisters and have the chance to work towards a place in that kingdom. So to conclude, we're just going to read quickly from one more parable concerning the servants and masters. And it's in Luke chapter 12. Be dressed and ready for service, and keep your lamps burning like men waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet, so that when he comes and knocks, they can immediately open the door for him. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. I tell you the truth, he will dress himself to serve and will have them recline at the table and will come and wait on them. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them ready, even if he comes in the second or the third watch of the night. And then from verse 42. Who then is the faithful and wise manager whom the master puts in charge of his servants to give them their food allowance at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whom the master finds doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of many possessions. So, brothers and sisters, let us make sure that we are those servants who are doing good when our master returns, and that we're commended as being good and faithful servants.
We will now sing hymn number 263, reading from the second verse. Our sins thy bruised body did bear upon the tree, and now we take the emblems in memory of thee. The broken bread, the token of thy dear body, Lord. The cup we take, remembering thy blood for us outpoured. Hymn 263.
Thank you.
For the benefit of our visitors, after the conclusion of the meeting, our brother Peter will be playing through a couple of times the hymn that we will be practicing this evening in the absence of any visitors. Remind you, the hymn number is 291. But now we're going to conclude our meeting with singing hymn number 210, and then we've asked Brother Paul Southgate to give the final prayer. So hymn 210. God of mercy, God of grace, show the brightness of thy face. Shine on Zion, Father, shine. Fill the world with light divine, and thy saving health extend unto earth's remotest end. Hymn 210.